on DAB Digital Radio, Digital TV, downloads and online.
Five Live. So we'll do box office top 10 and we'll start with Harry Potter, will we?
That would seem to be
Yeah, if that's what you want, I'll just do whatever you ask.
It's your
obviously,
choice.
It's not my show.
We can start with a Mexican film about vomiting, if you'd rather.
No, I'll start with a Hungarian. Is there a Mexican film about vomiting
it's
as well?
It's
just a vomit fest. You wait, you know, for a year and two come along at once.
The Mexican version is
El Vomitamos.
A reminder, we'll do this a number of times. Yep. Movies next week are on Tuesday. Between 3 and 4. Podcasters will not be affected. Star Wars Episode 4, A New Pope. Courtney Pike, the jazz angler. That's very good. Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Scone. Last Mango in Paris from yes. Matt in Glasgow. And I like
that. That is coming up later on, isn't it?
Dial N for nerd. Just appeals somehow. And on the subject of Latvian comedy films, I googled it, and it's, you know how it's, if you spell it wrong. Yes. I googled Latvian comedy movies, and it says, "Do you mean Latin comedy?" And this should be a box. We go, no. So the only thing I've found is The Shoe, which came out in 1998. It says, those who like small story greater meaning will enjoy this Cinderella meets Soviet paranoia in 1950s Latvia. Sounds a hoot, doesn't it? Okay, this email from Paul. Latvian, Latvians and Latvian 3 and the Latvian Resurrection.
Very good.
Is what he's going for.
Very good.
Mayo at bbc.co.uk. You can text 85058. Box office top 10 this week. At 10, Vacancy.
Which, you know, it's of all of those ones, it's the least obnoxious. And it at least does some of its job okay, but it runs out of steam in the last quarter.
Tell No One at 9.
Which I like very much. Adapted from an American novel, which I haven't read. A French adaptation story about a man who believes that his wife has died and then 8 years later starts getting emails from beyond the grave. Good twisty thriller. Too twisty at the end, but pretty good going.
La Vie en Rose at 8.
You know, a French movie about the short life of Edith Piaf. She only lived 40-something years, but it manages to pretend that World War II didn't happen at all. And Marianne Cotillard gives a real sort of hair, teeth, makeup performance, but doesn't do any of her own singing, which I do think leaves a gap in the middle of the film. I like to see, you know, Gary Busey doing his own singing as Buddy Holly, and Val Kilmer, much as I hate him, doing his own singing as Jim Morrison. And I know they say nobody sings like Piaf, but you know, if you're going to make a movie, then take some license.
At 7, it's not a misprint, it really is called Apne.
So I was at this festival yesterday doing this BAFTA Hitchcock screening, and Jess McConnell ran up to me and said, "That movie that you thought was a spelling mistake, what is it, Apne?" She said, I've seen it and I've got a review of it. So here it is. Apne, good boxing, drama, but too much men crying.
And that's it.
That's it. Well, I said keep it brief.
And that's what it was.
It was.
Hostel.
We're standing in a field.
If you've seen Apne and can do better, let us know. Hostel Part 2 at 6.
You know, Eli Roth, spanked, sent to bed, no supper, stop doing it.
Pirates of the Caribbean, 5, okay, we've done that. Yeah. Ocean's 13 at 4.
The mighty acting black hole of Julian Sands. The film is not as bad as Ocean's 12, but it's not as good as Ocean's 11, and it is a bunch of smug, rich people enjoying themselves.
At 3, 4, Rise of the Silver Surfer.
Which I'm still not sent on, but we've had so many people who are fans of the comic book writing and say, well, it's, you know, it's honourable, it's true to the source material. I don't think that's enough, but apparently if you're a diehard comic book fan of the Fantastic Four, it isn't making any horrible heretical mistakes, but it's just not doing anything else either. And Jessica Alba is rubbish in those films.
And number 2, Die Hard 4.0. Too many numbers.
And I didn't make the gag Die Hard 4.0, and I am really kicking myself. Whoever it was that emailed that in last week, I have literally spent a week. That's even worse than IKEA Nightly, than me not doing IKEA Nightly.
Well, it's picked up and repeated by Peter Smith, our listener in Prague. It says, Simon and Mark, after a dodgy meal of rabbit's head soup and fried offal with noodles, I decided to wreak revenge on my Chinese girlfriend by taking her to see Die Hard 4.0. This was in spite of her protesting that, and I quote, "The loud radio man says it's rubbish." Loud radio man, who we must assume is Dr. Kermode, admittedly had a point. It was appalling, so bad that actually I quite enjoyed it. She didn't speak to me for a full 30 minutes after leaving the cinema, sitting quietly in the bar later, ashamed of myself and gazing into my beer, avoiding eye contact. She finally broke the silence with, "You see, you must listen to the loud radio man. Confucius has spoken. Hope you both will.
But the funny thing is, I saw Die Hard, it was on my birthday. It was on July 2nd, and I saw it in the morning. And of all the things, it hasn't been a great year, of all the things I could have had to have sat through, it was was, you know, one of the least onerous. It's not terrible. It's just not any good. And it doesn't have any of the substance of any of the previous Die Hard movies. But there is something quite funny about the fact that, that Bruce has to keep his singlet on. And it is just like a collection of bits that you've seen from other films. But it's, you know, it's still not as bad as Pirates of the Caribbean.
Box office number one, Shrek the Third.
I took my kids to see it, and it was pretty much as predicted. You know, they enjoyed it, and the kids in, and it was, the cinema was pretty full, but I think it is totally unmemorable, and I do think that they have run out of steam. And the bad news here is that Shrek the Fourth, or Shrek 4.less, it will be happening in 2010, and I think that is a shame, because I did really feel by the end of Shrek the Third that they'd wrung everything out of it, and there wasn't any more mileage in it. And when you remember just how good the first Shrek was, actually just how good the second Shrek was, we are on a sort of downward spiral from here.
Three more typos for our new competition just while we're here. Raging Hull. Nick on the M56 is suggesting giant ukulele playing robots in Transformbiz, which is quite good.
I'd rather see that.
I still quite like Dial In for Nerd.
Dial In for Nerd, yes.
And Marco in Truro, I'd pay good money to see Tom Cruise in Top Canoe. Which obviously should be new, but
yes,
no, I know. Spelled GNU. So there, 850058 and mayo at bbc.co.uk. That's the top 10. These are new films out this week.
Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, which is the fifth, and it turns out the shortest Harry Potter movie. I checked these. Chamber of Secrets, 160 minutes. Goblet of Fire, 157 minutes. Philosopher's Stone, 152 minutes. Prisoner of Azkaban, 142 minutes. And this, 138 minutes.
Good
although,
start.
Yeah, it's, so they're reining it in, and it's a weighty tome, because actually the Harry Potter books have got bigger. You know, the first one, just like an ordinary sort of sized thing, but, you know, Christopher Columbus can't rein anything in at all. Directed by David Yates, who has now already signed on for the next one, and he won a BAFTA for Sex Traffic. He directed State of Play. He did Girl in the Cafe, the Richard Curtis thing. So he's, you know, he's a very, very acclaimed TV director, and he's, the job that he's done on this has impressed him so much, they've already signed him up for the next one, which I think is Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. So the plot, and I really hesitate to even start doing the plot, because there's a lot of plot in this film for 138 minutes. At the beginning of the movie, Harry is attacked in the real world, in inverted commas, by Dementors, and he pulls out his wand to save somebody's life. He is then expelled from Hogwarts for pulling out his wand in public, which he's not allowed to do. You don't, it's so below you. I'm trying to do the plot.
I haven't said a thing.
No, but you're smirking in, well, that kind of childish.
Only if you're watching the vodcast.
Yeah, and the Vipco, fine. And so he's then, he's expelled from Hogwarts, but of course he can't be expelled from Hogwarts for long. So then there is a meeting in which he's kind of unexpelled from Hogwarts. But then it turns out that Hogwarts has sort of been taken over by this new character. Dumbledore has sort of been sidelined. And Harry spends the whole of the movie being outcast, being cut off, being different, being sort of somehow withdrawn from all his friends. And everyone's got it in for him, not least, hello, Jason Isaacs. He is good, though, isn't he?
Hello, Jason.
Hello, Jason. I know that we're, you know, the friend of the show and everything, but he is really good. So, first criticism of the movie, I wanted more Jason Isaacs, because actually it's a significant but small role. There are several characters who turn up for significant but small appearances. And one of the problems that I have is it feels like an awful lot of business, an awful lot of plot, an awful lot of stuff, but it smacks very slightly of the middle film syndrome. It's rather like the Twin Towers. It's a little bit Star Wars-y occasionally, in that, you know, characters with funny names turn up, do a couple of lines, and then disappear. And I'm very aware watching it that if you'd read the book, that what the film must be doing is gesturing towards larger passages in the book. Nothing illustrates this better than there is a sequence in which, and in case you haven't read the book, and I know there are some people out there who haven't, including me, a key character, something terrible happens in relation to an arch, right? A big archway. You remember the bit I'm talking about?
Yep.
Fine. I had no idea what was going on.
But
it did matter, because apparently in the book, the whole thing about the archway is death, and you step through it, you can casually step through it. Apparently this is very, very important. In the film, not knowing that, I just felt like yet another bit of wand waving had happened, and I didn't get any of the sense of significance that should have happened with this particular character. Now, there are good points. Imelda Staunton absolutely steals the show as Dolores Umbridge.
How hideous is she?
She's like Margaret Thatcher on a broomstick, wearing the, you know, the Wizard of Oz, Wicked Witch of the West hat, and she is just fantastic. I mean, I think she's a great actress anyway, and she's terrific in Vera Drake, but she's just scary as sin, and does everything with this kind of this pink, you know, Jackie Onassis kind of outfit, but really, really uptight. And really, even the moment when she gets Harry to write lines, and he has to write out lines, "I must not tell lies," and as he writes them on the page, the words are scratched on the back of his hand. It seems so sadistic. I mean, it seems
in the book that bit goes on and on and on, and they cut it really short, and I was wondering how they're going to do that, because it's basically torturing a kid sequence.
It is, and it's I mean, even in the short version that we have, I mean, it's alarmingly well done. That you also, of course, you get, you know, the big special effects finale, and if you see it in the IMAX, I haven't seen the IMAX version, apparently the last 20 minutes are in 3D. I'm not, to be honest, totally sure that that's going to add anything, because there's a lot of movies in which the last bit is in 3D. It's like Freddy versus Jason, when the bit, oh, is it Freddy Goes to Hell, the bit when he actually goes into hell, you have to put the 3D glasses on. It's not for me, I'm not sold on that, but hey, if you want these sort of extra action spectacular, you've got that. So, generally, I think that the whole standard of the Harry Potters has come up. Obviously, Christopher Columbus couldn't direct Traffic. That was all rubbish. Then what you had was a Prisoner of Azkaban, proper director, proper story, beautiful looping structure, that fantastic thing of them following themselves, having gone back in time. It allows Hermione to say, does my hair really look like that from behind? But it also has just a beautiful symmetry to it. The last Harry Potter film, everyone talked about it being so dark. And it was dark, but it didn't have the great narrative simplicity. There is nothing, I don't think, in the new film to match the moment in the previous film, the kill the spare moment, the moment when Cedric dies and Cedric's father is left grieving over Cedric. And it is definitely true that that 12A certificate for that film, I thought, was very well justified. It said, incidentally, the Goblet of Fire 12A said, contains moderate fantasy violence, threat and horror. The 12A this time says, contains moderate fantasy violence and horror. So what they're omitting is the threat. And it is true that this is less threatening than the other one, which I think is, you know, it's important, because 12A certificate films are not for very young kids. I mean, there is darkness in it. I mean, actually, visually, the palette of it is very dark. And it's a fairly tough movie. And as some people have pointed out, there's no Quidditch anymore. You don't have Quidditch anymore. Now what you have, the nearest you get to light relief is snogging. So Harry gets to have his first snog. But rather unfortunately, he has his first snog and then the character disappears. I mean, she's then sort of cast aside. She turns up to snog Harry. There's a great line about how was it wet? She was crying. And then she kind of goes. And for me, I felt that the whole thing, even though it was the shortest Potter movie, felt long, because it felt like a lot of stuff. It felt like a lot of bits. It felt like you've been going and going and going and going and going, but you hadn't actually really got anywhere at the end. You still have the thing between him and Voldemort. You still have pretty much the same dynamic as you had before. You have substantially the same characters, except for the guy in the thing with the archway, which I don't want to reveal in case anyone doesn't know it, although I imagine it's all over the internet and every newspaper in the world, and you all know who it is.
It's not really that important. I mean,
no, but it ought to be important. The fact that that character goes through the ought to be staggeringly important. That's the whole point. And I was shocked to discover afterward that that was it. He's not coming back. It's like, because I was, funny enough, I was sitting there watching him thinking, I really like him. His character's really shaping up well. And if that is the end of him, if it is absolutely true that that character isn't coming back, then I needed more of that.
Well, you know he's not coming back because you hear the killing curse being said just before that. So.
Well, you may have heard the killing curse. I didn't have the, I don't know the books in the back of my head.
How on earth do you think Helena Bonham Carter got the part of Bellatrix Lestrange as a screaming mad old witch? How do you think
I
she
know,
got
it's
that?
Incredible, isn't it? Because, you know, they think, oh, we need somebody.
I think she had to try really hard.
Yeah, someone who's mad as a box of frogs. Is Helena busy? Because she's finished the Wallace and Gromit movie. And
How much did she enjoy that?
She is just cuckoo, isn't she? But she's fantastic. I mean, the fact is, Helena Bonham Carter, who would have ever guessed that person who was so annoying in Room with a View with Julian, beauty, truth, shut up, would turn into such a fantastic sort of goth icon. And she really has been. And she chews up the scenery. But again, she's on screen for about 3 minutes.
One other thing that you haven't mentioned that I think you probably should, and that is, I think it's Daniel Radcliffe's best performance. He really has to act all the way through, as he's not just a boy anymore. I mean, but he got very good reviews for Equus, but now he has to carry this film far more than any of the others.
The area in which they've lucked out is that it is amazing that of the three central performers who they cast when they were very young, that they have all three turned out to be decent adult, you know, older, young adult actors, because you really can never predict that sort of thing. And they must be really slapping themselves on the back for having chosen so well. It is true, the performances don't slip. My problem is that what I want from the incidental performances is more of them. I get the feeling that, you know, the Kingdom of Heaven, the Ridley Scott film, the long version seemed shorter and the short version seemed longer. Although I'm always in favour of brevity, I feel like it needed more space to breathe. I needed more Jason Isaacs. I needed more, you know, I needed more Alan Rickman. And he's there so briefly, and yet when he's there, he shines and he reminds you of just how great he was in the first.
There'll be a lot of him in the next one.
Will there?
Yes, there will.
Fine. But I don't want to feel like it's a holding pattern, and I have to confess that I did. And if you ask me to tell you the plot is pretty much the plot of The Two Towers. They walk and walk and walk and walk and walk and walk and walk, and then they stop. And then there's a little bit of snogging in between, and somebody goes through an archway kind of unnoticed. I do think he's a good director. I'm not, you know, I don't think he's a bad, I think he'll, maybe he'll do better with the next one. But this is nothing like as good as Azkaban, which still remains the shining pinnacle.
I agree with that, but it's better than the last one.
Get your Five Live podcasts from the Five Live website.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Including 606.
You made some good points, mate. I'm watching the game, holding my head in my hands.
Sports Week.
Wake Up to Money.
The Daily Mail.
Mark Kermode's film reviews.
And Fighting Talk. Click on the podcast link on the Five Live homepage.
You'll find full instructions on how to download.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
This is Five Live, talking movies. Mark Kermode is here. We've done Harry Potter, unless there's further correspondence on that. We have a typo competition running. Don't forget the vodcast and the podcast all available. She Wears a Yellow Gibbon.
That's good.
We've had this. It may well be that we've used the whole lot up by the end of today. So whether this continues or not, who knows? How the Vest Was Won, Sleeping with the Enema, Phil and Kirsten on the M40, Fridge Over the River Kwai would clearly be a different thing. That's Owen in Cambridge, who also suggests Where Beagles Dare. But anyway, if there are any other typos, this started from John in Barcelona, who suggests snacks on a plane because he had been genuinely offered dead clam. Which is a fine idea. Let us know if you can improve on that. So presumably, because we're in blockbuster mode.
Yeah, we are.
Everything else is for the kind of elite art house crowd.
Well, it's something called counter-programming, which is that you don't compete with Harry Potter. You give them something completely different. So other major release this week, Macbeth, or to give it its proper title, Macbeth, because it's not South African. That's my Australian accent, OK?
You'll find if you listen back.
That it's South African. All my accents sound exactly the same. They sound like a bloke from Barnet doing a silly voice. Several versions of Macbeth on screen. The best one, I think, of course, is the Polanski version, which is fantastic, despite the fact that it has Keith Chegwin going, "Mother, he has slain me." Ah! Right. So there have been several Macbeths before. As I said, the Polanski, although now my fantastic observation about Keith Chegwin and "Mother, he has slain me" is gone by the bite. There is, obviously, the Kurosawa's Throne of Blood, which is fantastic. There is also quite a few updated ones. Most famously, Joe Macbeth, which, as everyone remembers, got Sid James as Banky in it. And what we have now is the latest updated Macbeth, which is made by Jeffrey Wright. Jeffrey Wright made a film called Romper Stomper, which was the film that launched Russell Crowe's career. And it was a film about neo-Nazi skinheads in Melbourne. It was a big fuss when it came out over here. It was picketed by the anti-Nazi League, although of course it was never pro-Nazi. It was actually a very visceral piece of filmmaking with a great sense of performance by Russell Crowe, who then subsequently became a bit of an oaf, but he did very well in that film. So now Jeffrey Wright comes back with an updated version of Macbeth, and it's a Melbourne gangland tale with
seriously, stop doing it, it's really hard not to.
Because the story is, they're all Melbourne gangsters, right? Cawdor is a discotheque. The three weird sisters are clearly waitresses from Stringfellow's on a night off. And he meets them under a glitter ball where they tell him that there is some weird stuff afoot. And you know what? Macbeth actually gets down with the three weird sisters, which didn't happen in the version of the play that I read at school. You know, I'm sorry. But is this a digger I'll see before me? Is it a dirty digger? And so, look... It's all very post-Baz Luhrmann. What Baz Luhrmann did with Romeo plus Juliet, as it was, you know, as the title was written, was he took Shakespeare and he updated it and made it hip. And that was very exciting. In the same way that, for example, West Side Story or Forbidden Planet had done the same thing. And when I programmed the film season for the Royal Shakespeare Company last summer, I did include the Polanski Macbeth amongst that because it's a masterpiece. This is rubbish. I mean, the difficulty is, Macbeth is a very short play for a start. You can do pretty much the whole text in a fairly sort of tight period of time, and it's so well known. Of course it's very easy to update it as gangsters. Just give everyone guns and a bunch of drugs and having running around under glitter balls, and suddenly it seems to be updated. There's a terrific bit at the end when, because you know the whole thing is that I'm not giving away anything here, it's Macbeth, right? If you don't want to hear what happens in the end of Macbeth, turn your radio off now. But the thing about he will only fall when Burnham Wood comes, yes?
Yep.
So in the end, an articulated lorry carrying these logs, the Burnham Wood Company, comes smashing through the gate. So you think, well, okay, it's cheeky, it's trying hard, but it is rubbish. And the three weird sisters, who are actually obviously extras from Hot Gossip, I'm sorry, Where's the threat in that? And it's trying very hard to suggest that what it's doing is updating the text and, you know, making it hip and making it wow and making it hey wow amazing. And you think, you know what? I think that Shakespeare doesn't really need that. I mean, it's nice to know that people are still trying to find ways to update Shakespeare, but do something more inventive than just, you know, yeah, Macbeth as a modern gangland tale. We have heard this before, and it is true that the acting is, some of it is pretty right, mate, and there's some terrible haircuts in there. Everyone's got an awful mallet. It's like, you know, I don't...
That's enough. I've told you.
I'm sorry that Banquo's ghost is here, but his hair is really bad. They all look like Brian Bosworth, mate. Sorry, but it's hard not to mock, and in fact, I'm not even going to try.
You've just spent the last 5 minutes doing precisely that.
Yeah, I know, but it's kind of...
Can you give me an assurance now? When we get to the Mexican vomiting movie...
It's Hungarian.
Hungarian. Yeah. You're not even going to go close even try to sound Hungarian, because you know you'll just end up sounding like a Nazi.
But before we... What do you mean, as opposed to all the other times?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, before we get there, a re-release this week of Last Tango in Paris, the cause célèbre from the early 1970s Bernardo Bertolucci movie... Marlon Brando and Maria Schneider. The story is, well, I say story, I use the word very advisedly. Marlon Brando at the beginning has lost his wife. She's committed suicide, or maybe she hasn't. Maybe Marlon was involved. Maria Schneider is a really irritating, hippy-dippy young thing who's irritating hippy-dippy boyfriend is making an irritating film about her. They meet together in an apartment, no names, no pack drill, and they start having an intense erotic relationship, and it goes on, and Marlon does an awful lot of mumbling. A couple of interesting facts about the film. The line "go get the butter" was voted the 67th greatest line of all time by Premiere magazine in 2007. Several cases were brought against the film on sort of trumped up obscenity charges. I mean, it's interesting now seeing it, it's incredibly boring, but it clearly is not obscene. Over here, somebody from the Festival of Light attempted to prosecute it under the Obscene Publications Act, and then when that prosecution failed, they attempted to get it prosecuted as a record of a series of indecent acts between Brando and Schneider. But in fact, the even potentially racy content of the film is very, very small. Most of it is Marlon mumbling. And I think we have a clip of Marlon mumbling. And you need to remember this. This is the tipping point. When Marlon Brando began his career, there's things like On the Waterfront and, you know, Guys and Dolls. I mean, he's a fantastic actor. There is no doubting it. The Wobby, he's a really fantastic actor. Later on, we get him being Kurtz in Apocalypse Now. A snail crawling along the end of... Blah, blah, blah. And then we get all those other performances like Superman, which is Marlon. If you actually read the script, we'll pay you $1 billion and you only have to turn up for one day, and the whole of the rest of the week you can eat pies, okay? Because then afterwards, he gave up acting, so just wanted to eat. But anyway, here is a bit of Marlon. This is the point. He's just made The Godfather, so he's just won an Oscar, which of course he turned down. Remember, he sent Satchin Littlefeather to say Marlon doesn't want this. He's too busy eating pies, and incidentally, you're all horrible.
That was the real reason, was it?
It was, yes. Marlon would like to be here, but sadly,
eating a pie.
There's that thing in Viz magazine, which is that there's the shipyards up in Newcastle have been reinvigorated because they've got the contract to make a new pair of trousers for Marlon Brando, and it's going to last 4 years. I think the most interesting thing about it is it harks back to an age in which it was possible to make adult serious movies. I mean, Bernardo Bertolucci is a proper filmmaker. He later made The Dreamers, which he considered to be First Tango in Paris, which had a great run-in with the American censors. And there is some nostalgic charm in Last Tango being re-released, because people do not make films like this anymore. Catherine Breillat, who's the most pompous, boring French filmmaker, who makes these terrible films like Romance, which are full of people, you know, having wild, explicit stuff, but having a bad, in, you know, apartments that they really should, you know, nothing to worry about, but they just moan the whole
time.
Today
we have run the full gamut of your European repertoire.
We have. I'm a little islander, as you know.
We haven't got to Hungary yet.
No, and we will get there in just a second. And so, on the one hand, as a historical document, fabulous to see it, and some people would hold that it is Brando's greatest performance. I think it is completely self-indulgent waffle of the highest order. Some of the there's a speech in it which I can't quote, but if you've ever seen Flesh for Frankenstein, there's a fantastic speech in which Udo Kier pastiches it, in which he says, "To know death, Otto, you have to," and then fill in the blanks after that. So what I would say to you is this: if you want to go and see Last Tango in Paris, fine, go and see it. Believe me, take a cushion, you know, because it's a long, drawn-out thing. But afterwards, watch Flesh for Frankenstein. It's shorter and funnier. And Udo Kier gets my vote over Marlon Brando any day.
So, at long last, we reach our...
The Hungarian vomiting
the climax
movie.
Of the Spanish vomiting movie via Hungary.
It's not Spanish. Well, there are two. Okay, we'll just do two of these together, because there's a French movie, Molière, and there's the Hungarian vomiting movie called Taxidermia, okay? The story is three generations of Hungarian vomiting, really. It starts at the end of World War II when a horrible, lecherous character has horrible, lecherous, horrible interaction with lots of horrible things. And he then has a son who becomes the Hungarian speed-eating champion, who's kind of like Hungarian Mr. Creosote. It's like Mr. Creosote goes to Hungary, only more so. Mr. Creosote, but Hungarian, then has a son who's thin, and he stuffs animals. He is the taxidermist of the taxidermia title. And in a way, what the film is an extended sort of gag over three generations about different ways of stuffing things. The film features more throwing up than I've ever seen in a film before. And I have to say, I mean, I put it
on the poster.
Exactly. I mean, I've seen a lot of throwing up in my life in films, but I really felt at the end of the first 10 minutes of the speed vomiting stuff that the only way I can suffer this is I have to start rationalising. I'm looking at it, I'm going, that's CGI vomit, isn't it? And once I realised that the vomit was CGI, I was mightily relieved because, you know, back in the 1970s, if you wanted to do that kind of thing with like The Exorcist, you had to get a horse bit and put it, you know, with a spray thing. It was very, very complicated. But now you can do CGI vomiting, and that's really what all that digital universe has brought us to. And there are moments when you look at Taxiderm and you think, well, there's a sensibility at work there. He's obviously seen a lot of David Lynch films. I mean, it's like David Lynch goes to the toilet, but he has seen a lot of David Lynch films. And I'm sure that there is some great philosophical political point at the back of it, which is something to do with all politics is regurgitating. I'm sure there's some point. But the problem is when your gag reflex is being touched quite so heavily, most of that goes out the window and you just think, I want it to end because I want to stop watching people be sick. And then it did end, and I was very glad.
Gag reflex, though, very good.
In comparison with which, Molière, which is the French film out this week, which is, I mean, even
just
on the...
don't, okay... just in English.
Yeah. Even on the poster, it says it's the French Shakespeare in Love. It is Molière en amour. See, that's, you know, my...
That's enough.
The story is that Molière, very early on in his career, has been thrown into debtor's prison, and he gets a job being employed by a sort of nobleman to teach the nobleman how to act so the nobleman can woo his love. Meanwhile, Molière, who's...
Molière.
Who is? I'm doing it in Australian. He's called Molière, mate. I tell you, he said, "Is this a French poet I see before me?" Struth, blimey! Falls in love with the nobleman's wife, and there's a lot of all that stuff about people hiding under tables while other people come in and have conversations, and somebody's dressed up as a priest, and somebody else has got a ladder, and somebody's running around in their underwear in the garden. And the whole deal is that this is how Molière. Let's call the whole thing off.
No, it is Molière. That's it.
Fine.
There isn't an alternative. That's what it is.
This is how he became the great French farcist that he is. And, you know...
That's not a word.
No, it isn't, but it is now. And it's nonsense, and it's fluffy nonsense, and it has quite a nice central performance by Laura Morant, who I quite liked, and the rest of it is fluff and tosh and piffle. But on the other hand, if I had to choose between that and the Hungarian vomiting, I want the big, fluffy, you know, snow cake of a film, because it's what I... It's more wholesome.
Our final typos... Angels with Dirty Feces. It's a Wonderful Lift. Four Weddings and a Funnel. And Lady Chatterley's Rover.
That's very good.
That'll work.
That's very good. Lady
Along
Chatterley's
with Last
Rover.
Horse in the Loft and Last Notes on a Sandal and The House Whisperer. Thank you very much indeed for all of those. Don't forget, our movies next week are on Tuesday because of the golf. That's Tuesday between 3 and 4. And this week's Movie of the Week.
Well, it is Harry Potter, isn't it?
You surprised me. I thought you'd go for Spanish vomit, but we're...
It's Hungarian, but it is Harry Potter.
Okay, more movies on Tuesday. Have a good weekend.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.